From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On the move, dispatched and dispersed, hundreds of thousands of Gulf Coast Americans from every walk of life have walked, driven, hitchhiked, or been bussed, choppered, or flown out of the wreckage and flooding of Hurricane Katrina. Across the country, a rough diaspora is underway, with the displaced from New Orleans and beyond searching for some place to hunker down and figure out their next step. Texas Governor Rick Perry says his state, next door to Louisiana, needs help with the influx. Other states and homes around the country are opening their doors to this mammoth exodus. But what the future holds for Katrina's exiles is a big question and a national question. This hour, On Point, On the Move, the mass migration of Gulf Coast Americans displaced by disaster. You can join the conversation. Have you moved out of Katrina's path of destruction? Are the doors to your community open to Gulf Coast Americans? And what is happening, what will happen with all these people? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To get a sense of just one piece of the evacuee problem and response, we turn to Terry Langford. She's a reporter with the Houston Chronicle. Terry, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
We see your governor, Rick Perry, saying we need help. Almost a quarter million evacuees have come into Texas, 100,000 staying in hotels and motels around the state, 139,000 in 137 shelters around the state from the Astrodome to El Paso. Has Texas reached its kind of a maximum intake point?
Well, Governor Rick Perry has said yes, we have reached that point. He also said, and I spoke to him just a few minutes ago while he was touring with former President Bush and former President Clinton over at the Astrodome, he said that I think that some people are receding. Some people are either going back home. We don't have any numbers. It's not a great number, but we're also having to work in the transition phase. So you're going to see Texas in the next few days probably go more to a transition phase, how to absorb the people that will stay here.
So he's saying we're turning from a target or a destination into a transit point. We read that the Texas National Guard is going to coordinate air operations, moving people from Texas on to other states.
Right.
And there are now many that have opened their doors to evacuees.
Right. Some are going to stay, some are going to move, and it's still not clear. That effort, that airlift effort that was announced by the governor, and I think part of it was through frustration with efforts here to find places for people, has been taken over, I've just been told, by FEMA. FEMA will be taking over that airlift operation, and other states have offered. So Texas does have the bulk because of sheer location. Some will be moving on, but right now we're in such flux, some will probably remain here, and we just don't know how many yet.
A lot of immediate issues for evacuees, where to get Social Security checks if they need them, how to get medicine, how to get mail, how to locate missing relatives and pets and get their youngsters into school, all of that being addressed in the Texas Astrodome
we
and beyond?
We can speak in Houston, yes. The U.S. Postal Service about 3 days ago announced that they're setting up a sort of delivery mail address and a zip code just for the Astrodome and the area here. There are Social Security representatives on site who are collecting information and making sure that benefits get to the people that still that got them in Louisiana.
And more intake points as well. We see in Fort Chaffee, Arkansas, now a processing center where evacuees can register with the Social Security Administration, get checked by doctors, be given post office boxes. We talked a few days ago about what might happen with evacuees and their children in school. How is that working? Are they being funneled into Texas schools?
They are being funneled into Texas schools. The enrollment process is still going on. But, yes, they are being enrolled into the Houston Independent School District.
And now we hear about many other states that are beginning to have considerable numbers, as far north as Michigan and Massachusetts. What's the sense among Texans that you're picking up, Terry? Is this still, a crisis and we're opening our arms to fellow Americans? Is there nervousness about the number of people who are flowing into their midst?
I think there is. It's not something that anyone wants to speak about, but I think on the whole, people want to help the neighbor just to the east of them. But there is an undercurrent of, what does this mean for us? Does this mean we're going to displace perhaps people who've been on public housing rolls, you know, for public housing? The governor has gone out of his way, and so have local leaders, to say it's not going to happen. No one in Texas will be displaced over evacuees, but it's just going to be a separate sort of registration process, money flow, as it were. For instance, a FEMA check. FEMA can give someone up to 18 months worth of housing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not going to interfere with, say, someone in the city of Houston who's been waiting to get on a public housing or public assistance list.
So they've
gone to great effort to distinguish that.
A different line of resources. And what about the fundamental sort of baseline expectation here? Many people have lost their homes, but others still have homes that are just inundated, flooded. Officials, government officials, are now warning, you know, of a potentially impossible future in New Orleans and maybe elsewhere. A destroyed city there without food, water, power, the specter of cholera, typhoid, mosquitoes, and all the rest. Are Texans looking at the evacuees from New Orleans and the Gulf as though they're temporary or they are here to stay?
I think most Texans realize that this is a beyond catastrophic event. And that, while I can't speak for them, the sense is they're going to be here for a while, and I think that they've accepted that. There's a ton of relief agencies, local businesses that are coming up to the plate that are trying to help them either absorb them here in this economy or get them where they want to go, if they want to go back. And I just think it's so soon that no one it's a moving target all week.
Mm.
Lots of professionals in this area have friends who lost homes, who are putting them up on couches. As far as, you know, I talked to someone in Texas College Station, about 90 miles from here.
Yeah.
They're putting up colleagues on that they know from Tulane and Loyola and all the university systems. There's just no telling right now.
A public response and a private response, much of which you don't even see. It goes on beyond the radar. Terry Langford, we appreciate your report from Houston very much. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Terry Langford, reporter for the Houston Chronicle. She spoke with us from Houston. Well, joining me now in the studio is Rhody Chambliss. She is a native of New Orleans, born and bred there. She now lives and works in the Boston area. She and her extended family have spent the last week trying to help their family members get out of New Orleans and into temporary accommodations. It is a very personal story and a very immediate story. Rhody, thank you so much for coming in today.
You're welcome.
So how's it going? Tell us about your roots in New Orleans and who's still there and who's out in your family.
The majority of my family, and my mother had 11 brothers and sisters, and my father has a huge family there. All of my family's in New Orleans, and the biggest problem has been finding out where people who didn't evacuate before the storm,
mm-hmm.
and who evacuated or not evacuated after the levees broke, finding where people are has been the hardest thing. The Astrodome and a lot of the shelters do not have a systematic way of documenting who's come through.
Right.
People are writing on bulletin boards on top of names and
but no
on
central
scraps
database.
Of paper. Mm-hmm. And it's ridiculous. In this day and age, I don't see why the information, the Red Cross does have a little database with a few hundred names in it, but I don't know who is coordinated. If someone goes through that shelter, mm-hmm. they should be documented right off.
What about your family at this point? How many are still in New Orleans? How many have moved out? How many are whereabouts unknown?
There are people whose whereabouts are unknown. Every day we're finding out new information of where people are. At this point, it's difficult. We're trying to maintain hope because there are people who are located in the area worst hit in the city.
This is the Ninth Ward.
Well, in Gentilly, which is near the UNO, University of New Orleans mm-hmm. area, closer mm-hmm. to the lake, which is a little north of the Ninth Ward.
Their houses underwater or in deep water or not?
It's hard to tell. On mm-hmm. the internet, there are plenty of pictures, and from an aerial shot, it's hard to tell if it's, you know, 10 feet or 20 feet or...
You still have immediate relatives in New Orleans, not yet evacuated?
We have immediate relatives that we cannot locate.
And some that you can locate or not?
Yeah, we
is
have plenty.
Your grandmother, is she still there?
We have plenty that were able to get out. My grandmother actually went to Mississippi. We have people who went west to Baton Rouge, and we have people who went to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people, actually no one in my family that I know of went to the Superdome or the convention center.
In other words, to the public facilities.
Exactly.
They all had relatives or...
They evacuated to relatives before the storm, and the people who were there after the storm were either in their homes or they were working. A lot of people didn't leave because they were working.
They had jobs and they wanted to stick with those jobs.
The jobs, one aunt was in the hospital. She works in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
She's worked there for 26 years. You know, that's allowed her to pay her mortgage. And they say, well, if you'll bring your family in here, you can work. You know, just bring. So she brought her husband in and my little cousin to the hospital. And they were there when the levees broke and everything flooded and the water came up to the first floor. And, you know, so it wasn't just a matter of you see on the news where they just assume things
right.
about
what
people
were these people
that
thinking,
stayed.
Not leaving, there
people
are reasons.
Stayed cause they, mm-hmm. because they couldn't get out. They didn't have cars or they didn't have money. Some people stayed because of their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
I have family members that work for the police department, for the 911. People, you know, I think if someone had put it to them, you know, if you don't get out, there's a chance that you could die.
Mm-hmm.
That was never.
But who would think that way? Rudy Chambliss, we're delighted to have you here as a reality check right through this hour. Please stick with us. We are talking about the Gulf Coast's displaced Americans. You can join the conversation. Are you part of the exodus from New Orleans, from the Gulf? Where have you landed? How are you doing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Gulf Coast's displaced Americans, about Katrina's nomads, Katrina's homeless, Katrina's refugees. Call them what you will. You can join us in this hour. I say call them what you will, but whatever you call them, open your hearts and your help to them. And we're looking at exactly what their future may look like, not to mention their present in this hour. You can join the conversation. Is your town, your city, your school taking in Katrina's displaced? Have you seen the thousands and thousands with nowhere to go? And what's going to happen to the crowds in the Astrodome and school gymnasiums and you name it right across the lower tier of the country? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio and very happy to be this hour by Rudy Chambliss, born and raised in New Orleans, big extended family there and around New Orleans that has been trying to look out for its own over the last week, but it is not easy. She is our reality check on everything that we're hearing here this morning. Right now we're joined from Gainesville, Florida, by Anthony Oliver Smith. Tony Oliver Smith is professor of cultural anthropology at the University of Florida. He's author of The Angry Earth, Disaster in Anthropological Perspective. Tony Oliver Smith, thanks for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
So here we're looking at a major outflow, hundreds of thousands of people out of their homes along the Gulf. How are we doing so far?
Well, I think that given the fact that there was, there were serious problems with the issue of preparedness, right now I think it's basically ad hoc. They're just trying to develop systems to handle this problem. There's been nothing like this since probably the 1927 floods in Mississippi, the lower Mississippi Valley, which displaced somewhere near 700,000 people, and approximately 330,000 were interned, actually in camps.
We heard that story on National Public Radio last weekend, and it was astounding. In particular, poor black residents of the area held essentially captive on levees. Because employers were afraid that if they left, they would not come back to work the fields and rebuild.
Yeah, well, they were right. Actually, it was that flood was probably one of the key features or the key forces that stimulated a lot of migration out, and it was pretty permanent migration.
You've raised a number of points, things for us to watch in relationship to this evacuation. Tony Oliver Smith. You say, first of all, the problems that face the displaced, the search to reconnect with family, the insecurity of who they are once they've lost all their immediate surroundings, the stigmatization that go along with being a quote-unquote refugee, whether you like it or not. Wade into those waters with us and the problems these people are likely to face.
Sure. Let's start with the whole idea of the loss of self. In some ways, we create ourselves out of our surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
That is, our links with other people, our family relationships. All of those things are part of how we make up ourselves. And of course, our surrounding environment, our job, our neighborhood, all those linkages go into making up an identity. And what displacement does generally, displacement, uprooting, and very often resettlement in strange surroundings, is to break a lot of those linkages. So what happens is you have to kind of reinvent yourself. It's a very complex task. It's a very complex challenge. People need support in this. And I think this is going to be exaggerated perhaps in the circumstances in the United States, where we tend to relocate people as individuals or perhaps as families, but rarely as communities.
Tony Oliver Smith, if you'd hold that thought for a minute, I've got Rhody Chambliss with me in the studio. Her family, an old New Orleans family, and I can see her nodding along. Rhody, I know that your father built the house with his own hands, I believe in the Ninth Ward there.
My grandfather.
Your grandfather, excuse me.
Actually in the uptown area,
okay.
Wasn't flooded as badly
mm-hmm.
as the rest of the city.
But I'm thinking of this connection to the way we define ourselves by where we live and how we live. Mm-hmm. He came home from the war with a war buddy. They mm-hmm. built homes side by
exactly.
side. Presumably, your family understands itself through that very specific geography
exactly.
and location.
In fact, the man that my grandfather went to the war with, his son stayed in the house just as my uncle stayed in my grandmother's house.
Last week.
Yeah, they mm-hmm. went through the hurricane together. And even though a family member who had escaped to Texas went back to fetch more people that had gathered at mm-hmm. the house because mm-hmm. it was still standing, even though there was water in the street,
mm.
they left. And my grandmother still called me and told me to check on him and see if he was okay, because he's part of our family as well.
That is the relatives next door.
Exactly.
The heirs of the war buddy of your grandfather
exactly.
who built
side
by side.
And we all grew up together. And I think that the other guest hit on something very important in terms of identity. And I believe that the people who have evacuated from New Orleans are going to be dealing with that. And also people who grew up from the area and love the area are also going to be dealing with that. You know, who are you when the place that defines you mm. is no longer there, or it's different, so different that it's not what you remember.
Tony Oliver Smith, we heard this in the voice of Rhody Chambliss when she called us last week. You can hear it again this morning. It's something you talk about, the stigmatization of refugees, if we want to call them evacuees here. At some level, Rhody pointed out to us last week, it began before the cameras even pulled away from New Orleans. But as evacuees land in other communities around the country, what is that dynamic, Tony Oliver Smith? We see parades and almost welcome for people at one point, but does that turn into some kind of stigma?
Well, it can, certainly, and it's not uncommon in a lot of disasters the initial sort of compassion that people show, that tends to dissipate relatively rapidly as things return to some kind of normality. You get an enormous solidarity in the initial stages. This is really pretty common. But as things return to something, you know, approaching normal in the sense that, people are sheltered, then very often that identity shifts and people start considering disaster victims as freeloaders. And there's a kind of stigmatization that goes along with that. Mm. It's something that's very well documented and very unfortunate.
Globally, you can see why families like Rhodey's might want to cling to the place where they're known, where they have standing, where they have roots in history. I want to begin to turn to our callers, if I may. Pamela is calling from Boston. Hi, Pamela. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yes, Pamela. What do you think? What do you know?
Well, I have a stepbrother who lived on Esplanade Ave in the French Quarter.
Mm-hmm.
My sister also lived 30 miles west, and she drove out and headed to Florida, to my mom's house.
Right.
And she couldn't get him to leave. He's about 30 years old. I've been on the phone, on the internet. I've called my mother every day. Nobody has heard from him. He's lost. We don't know if he... The last thing we heard, he was going to try to get to the convention center. We don't know if he got there. We don't know if he survived. You know, this sense of, you know, helplessness of trying to... I've gone to Katrina survivors, Craigslist. I've put
right.
up all kinds of things on the internet, and we haven't been able to locate him. And the feeling that he's just missing somewhere, and there's no documentation, just like Rhodey was saying.
Yes.
That how does one go about finding out about their relatives? In the sense of hopelessness, I've cried, I've stayed up all night.
Yeah.
We don't know where he is.
And this, after you've worked, it sounds as though you've worked all the resources available to you. I will throw one thing out here. We want to be very practical, even as we talk about the larger framework here. The government has asked the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to use its clearinghouse as a national sort of phone number where you can call and check. It doesn't mean that they're going to be on top of every case, but let me just give that number. It is 888-544-5475. That's the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, but that is being used in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina for anyone to try and reconnect with family members of any age, 888-544-5475. 75. If I may ask you, Pamela, you're still dealing with where people are, but what about where they're going to be? We hope and pray your stepbrother will be found. You've already got people who have driven to relatives. What are their onward plans? Are they looking to get back to New Orleans or to restart elsewhere?
Well, my sister lives in La Place, which is in St. John the Baptist Parish, and she's going to, if she can get gas, drive back home. Her house is safe, only the mailbox blew over. But she has her in-laws, her husband's family, lived a mile from the breach in the levee, an industrial breach.
Right.
And so now there's about seven or eight of them who will now have to go and pile up on her four-bedroom home with her husband, and her daughter. So now there's going to be this massive amount of people living in her house for God only knows how long, as well as the fact that my brother-in-law worked at the convention center.
Oh, boy.
Loss of income.
Right.
You know, overcrowding. I mean, it's a beautiful home, four bedrooms. They'll probably end up putting people in their two-car garage. But this is, my whole thing was, you know, that there were so many poor people who were left there, left behind, and why didn't the buses come and get them out? But, you know, I know we're not talking about that.
Yeah, we all felt that pain, and now it's looking forward, and those issues of who has resources and who don't continue to be right there. Pamela, thanks for calling in. Rhodey, I see you nodding your head at all of this. There's been a lot of talk about the haves and have-nots as the storm hit and in the aftermath here. You've already pointed out you had relatives who just couldn't deal with the idea of walking away from a job, because once you leave that job, where are you going
exactly.
to get another?
Exactly. My aunt worked at the hospital, and, you know, people, I mean, unless you want to just quit, she decided to stay. When they evacuated the hospital, they put them out on the street where the water was only maybe 3 feet high, and they waded to my grandmother's house to safety. They were able to make it out of the city. She went from being employed at the hospital, and she and her husband own a business. They own a very successful bar that I went to this past Mother's Day, lines around the block.
Yeah.
And now they're having to sleep on the floor in a cousin's house in Baton Rouge. So a lot of people who went from homeowners, working hard every day, owning small businesses, and it's not... There's a cross section. It's not all one thing. People are at different levels. And there are people who've never had to collect a check ever. And right now, they
still... You mean
still,
who don't work for...
Who've never had to collect assistance, public assistance.
Oh, I see. Right, right.
And so they still have not gone to FEMA. They still have not signed up officially in anything because they've been in family members. They've been in hotels on credit cards, and we've wired money. Western Union has been offering discount rates for Katrina.
But a lot of economic infrastructure wiped away here.
Yeah, and it's a lot of it's being shouldered by the family members.
There's a huge range of people affected. I want to welcome into our conversation right now from Houston, Texas, Scott Cowan. He is president of Tulane University, which has... Essentially, President Cowan, you tell us, but it sounds as though it's been essentially shut down by Hurricane Katrina. Is that correct?
Yes, our campus is in New Orleans. We have a number of campuses across the country, but the ones in New Orleans are now closed. We will reopen in the spring. And what we're working on right now is building our information technology and communications infrastructure here in Houston so we can begin to communicate effectively with people every single day and get up and running as a university and then begin the recovery process to restore our campuses in New Orleans.
President Cowan, you bring this even bigger spectrum of impacts here into focus. You've got individuals, some with resources, many without, trying to figure out what their future is in New Orleans or beyond. Tulane, a lot of resources, but a city that's in big trouble right now. Are you assuming, is it your absolute assumption that you will go back to New Orleans, or is that in question?
It is not in question at all. We will go back to New Orleans. The best thing that Tulane University could do for itself and for New Orleans is to restore itself in New Orleans. We are the largest private employer in Orleans Parish. We are probably one of the largest economic engines for New Orleans. The faster we can get up and running, the better off not only Tulane University will be, but the city will be.
But it's not entirely up to you, is it? We're talking weeks, months. We've even heard half a year or more before New Orleans is habitable again. And then these questions about the ongoing toxicity and what will be rebuilt. Do you have any question that New Orleans itself will be restored?
I have no question it will be restored. It is a question of timing, and the answer to that becomes how much of it is New Orleans a priority to the federal government. If it is a priority, then they will put whatever resources are needed into New Orleans to get it up and running. And that should not take 6 months or 9 months, because if it takes that long, then it's not the priority it should be for the United States. We can work miracles as a nation. We have done it every place else. If we can't even do it in the United States in our own city, what does that say about us? So I have no doubt it can be done. And the question is, how high a priority is New Orleans to the United States and to this federal government?
President Cowan, president of Tulane University, what about your students at this point? Where are they? They are a kind of evacuee population themselves.
Our students are being taken care of all over the country. We worked out an agreement with literally hundreds and thousands of universities to take our students for one semester only as visitors, with the idea that they would return to New Orleans and to Tulane University in the spring. And we are working on that basis. We are in contact with them. And I have to tell you, the outpouring of support and assistance from higher education has been remarkable and is a real source of hope for all of us who are working night and day to bring our institutions back.
And let me ask you, from your vantage, again, as president of Tulane, what's your assessment of the first week since Katrina? We've heard a lot of outrage from local officials there at the government response. What do you say, President Cowan?
I am also equally outraged by the federal government response. I was there during the storm, and I stayed 4 days thereafter. Tom, the day of the storm, when it was over, I walked out on our campus, and there was debris and some damage, but it was clearly manageable, something we could deal with. But Tuesday, the levee broke, and that was the moment that something had to be done instantaneously, and then it was not. And as a result of that, within 24 hours, that entire city was flooded, with some exceptions. And then that flooding led to a cascading emergency situation in there, and I think it took the federal government and others probably 2 or 3 days, but by then the damage was so extensive that putting it back together again is going to be much more complicated than it would have been if someone had acted right away.
Scott Cowan, president of Tulane University, speaking with us, an evacuee himself at this hour from Houston, Texas. President Cowan, thank you very much for joining us.
Nice being with you, Tom.
Tony Oliver Smith, Rhody Chambliss, please stick with us. We're talking about the Gulf Coast's displaced Americans. You can join the conversation What about this word, refugees? Is it an insult to the displaced of Katrina, or does it respect what they are now up against? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Gulf Coast's displaced Americans. Katrina's homeless, Katrina's refugees, call them what you will. What do you think if New Orleans is out of commission for 6 months? What should, what will happen to these evacuees? And has Katrina hit your family, your town, with upheaval? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, joined from Gainesville, Florida, by Tony Oliver Smith, professor of cultural anthropology at the University of Florida. And with me in the studio, Rhody Chambliss, born and raised in New Orleans, big family there, some of whom now evacuated to relatives in Kentucky and Texas, some still in New Orleans, some whereabouts unknown. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Scott's calling from Richmond, Virginia. Hi, Scott. You're on the air.
How are you?
We're well. What do you think?
Well, there's a couple different questions. Obviously, trying to find a way to help wherever you can, and being in Richmond, you know, you bring up the issue of evacuees or refugees, and what are they, and how far out will they disperse? I brought the point up of, you know, I have room available in my home, and is there a network to say, you know, from a temporary standpoint, what other might there be?
Yeah, that's a great question. You've got room. Can you contribute it in your home? How do you coordinate that? I don't know if we have the answer to that. The Red Cross might be a coordination point. Tony Oliver Smith, are you aware of a central planning or coordination point for people who want to offer room and board to evacuees?
I think that probably the local Red Cross will have those links for people who want to offer shelter or housing. That's what I would do in terms of connecting, is going to either the Red Cross or the Salvation Army for information. Information is always at a premium in disasters like this. So,
let me ask you about some of the more grand plans near New Orleans. Here I see the commander of the Army Corps of Engineers, Lieutenant General Carl Strzok, talking about the agency. They're looking at sites where they could put up trailer and mobile home parks to house large numbers of evacuees, potentially creating a city of 50,000 people, quoting him, where none exists now, for evacuees from New Orleans. Is there a history of doing that kind of thing in disasters like this, Tony Oliver Smith?
Yeah, there is. The trailer or mobile home solution is one that FEMA has used quite a lot. They used it during Hurricane Andrew in Miami in 1992, and they've used it elsewhere, but I don't think ever quite to this scale. This is the big dilemma that faces FEMA. There's always this problem of the temporary versus the permanent. Creating a settlement for 50,000 people, whether it's 50,000 families or 50,000 people, this is going to be, you know, an enormous engineering and organizational challenge. It's also going to be a major social challenge.
What do you mean? I guess two questions. What do you mean by that challenge? And is it a good idea to build new temporary cities? What's the record when that's done?
Well, it's not very good. Resettlement of this sort is always a major challenge. We just we don't do it terribly well. The problem is, of course, that the temporary has a tendency to convert itself into permanence. Mm. And so you create on the outskirts of New Orleans a vast mobile home park that is probably distant from employment. It's distant. It's just out there as a, you know,
right,
as a kind of settlement without any kind of real support, economic or social support structure. It could degenerate fairly quickly into basically creating a slum.
Rhody Chambliss, I've seen you nodding along with Scott Cowan, president of Tulane, and nodding again just now. You've got a lot of family affected by this, deep roots in New Orleans. What are you thinking about these options, whether it's the people in the Astrodome or private individuals taking folks in, or the idea of temporary cities that might become permanent, might become slums? How do you think about the range of options for your family, for your community?
Just to give an example that I told to one of your producers, Saturday, two of my aunts called. We had a one-hour freeway conversation where I was searching transportation options on the internet. We did this big cost-benefit analysis of how can we move five people from Houston to Atlanta. Should they take the plane? Should they take a bus? Should they rent a car? How much is the gas?
This and is we, family members
yeah,
that you need to
all
relocate.
All three of us.
Yep.
Coming up with these plans. And so when we finally figure out what we quote unquote were going to do, we called the cell phone of my aunt in the hotel. And she
this
said,
is in Houston.
In Houston. And she said, wait a minute, we haven't figured out what we want to do. And what I'm not
nobody
hearing,
asked me.
Yeah, what we're not hearing is that people, everyone's making different decisions based on, you know, their personal circumstances and what's important to them. And they had not even decided what they wanted to do. And it turns out that for them, they people who are attached to the city, who own property, who have businesses, want to go back into the city. They wanted to go closer to New Orleans and go to Baton Rouge. They didn't want to go to Atlanta.
So you're finding out within your family
and
what the whole country's likely to find
and
out.
So some people, too. If they didn't own anything or if they were younger, we're seeing differences between if people are older, if they own something, they want to go back. Some of the younger people were in college. They say, well, I can go here. I can get a job. And so people are making different decisions. And I hope that whoever's making these decisions on rebuilding and these temporary cities and all this kind of stuff, they need to talk to the people. I feel like people's basic rights and decision making capabilities. Let's call them citizens. Let's not call
please.
Them evacuees.
Well,
they're citizens.
Both at the moment, but we see them as citizens.
They need to be involved in deciding the course of their own lives, you know. And we were trying to make these decisions from a position of love and caring. And so we didn't do a great job because it didn't even occur to us to
Within
ask
your
what
own
they
family.
Want.
Yeah.
So what is FEMA going to do? They're just going to rustle up people like, you know, like they have no agency or right to choose where they live
themselves. Though we hear the director of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, rather sternly saying, we don't want people trying to head back into New Orleans. It's going to take a long time to clean this up. Well, then what? Let's continue to hear it from the folks who have had to deal with this. Wyoming is calling from Boston. Hi, Wyoming, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're well. What do you know? What do you see?
Well, my whole family and friends, including myself, and we all left safely. Everyone's safe and sound.
You left New Orleans, or?
Yes. I live in uptown New Orleans, and I have family here. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts.
How and when did you get out, Wyoming?
Everyone left. Neighbors caravaned out of there when everybody realized it was a very serious storm, so it was time to get up and go. And we luckily, like some people who were seeing a lot of footage of, we had the means to get out, and some people didn't. And I don't necessarily want to just focus on that, but I wanted to relay some information.
Yes, please.
Somebody was asking about where they could offer to help, such as housing, et cetera. And it's been very helpful for myself and other neighbors and friends who have been displaced to go through a website, which I'll give you if that's allowed.
Yes, please. What is it?
It's the local newspaper down there. The Times-Picayune has been publishing online. They have a website. It's NOLA.com.
NOLA.com for the Times-Picayune website. And is it useful?
It's so useful. It's it's up to the second. All the message boards have tons of information. And I guess the most important thing is not the specific information about your neighborhood, about your house, which is all, at least for me, very hopeful, but just the general feeling of people that are very positive and they want to rebuild our city and they want to be a part of it, like that woman before me said.
Right. Wyoming, let me ask you, we've got you on the line from New Orleans, out of New Orleans, and Rhody Chambliss, who has a lot of family there. I want to just hear you two speak to us about this issue. of means. There's been a lot of discussion of white, black, rich, poor since Katrina hit and in the aftermath. How should we be factoring that in to how we understand the future of the residents of New Orleans who are now scattered? Rhody.
Looking at the news footage, I've had some of the same feelings, but I think it's just part of the bigger picture. And so people who are, it's the numbers, it's the statistics. But I will say in New Orleans that I saw a lot of stories where people were helping each other. And they saw each other as people, and it wasn't.
That's right.
You know, and if you,
I remember you didn't like to focus on the shooting and lawlessness. You thought that was overblown.
I thought it was despicable because the people in New Orleans are hardworking and generous, and they help each other, and neighbors of different races live next to each other, and they help each other. And I just thought it presented a very inaccurate picture. And I'm sure that the caller would agree that New Orleans is full of neighbors. Everyone is your neighbor.
Wyoming, let me ask you about that. You said your family had means. I don't know, but I'm guessing you're white. Did you feel guilt when you looked back to New Orleans, saw the TV pictures coming out of the convention center, largely black faces there? What did you feel? What was going through your mind?
Well, I just completely agree with what the other caller is saying, and I think we're just grateful that we were able to leave, and we feel sadness for the city and the people who couldn't leave. I totally agree with her. My neighborhood is what they call, what we all call sometimes checkerboard, you know, neighbors of different classes, races, everything living together, and most of New Orleans is like that, and I think that that's why we like living there. That's one of the reasons why we like living there. And I think that every city has a little bit of that, but in other big cities, it's a bit more segregated. That's my experience. And so that you don't realize that you have poor, underprivileged, undereducated people living in your city. In New Orleans, that's what it is. That is what's going on, and we are aware of that because you live next to it. It's not segregated from you.
And now the whole country is aware, but I see Rhody Chambliss, African-American, nodding in agreement with you about that checkerboard that's been left there. Of course, the community, when it's broken through evacuation, is not necessarily easy to put back together, especially when the streets are flooded and flooded toxically. I want to get one more call here. Prima Latisse is calling from Randolph, Massachusetts. Prima Latisse, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling to join in the conversation. You know, the show's been really good so far, but I wanted to start out by saying that I am an African-American person, mm-hmm. and seeing all of these people of color on television. I've been to, my sister's lived there with her family, her husband, her family for years. And, you know, we love New Orleans. I've met lots of great people there who are people of color as well as Caucasians.
Yes.
And so when I'm seeing all of these, you know, people on TV, and they are African Americans and they're not necessarily represented in a good light,
mm-hmm.
That makes me wonder what's going to happen now, since these people who have had to leave, who are you know, are going to different states. And so, you know, that's the real reason for my call. My sister and her family are fine. She's in Houston with a cousin. My nephew is actually in Baton Rouge with the husband's family. But at any rate, they did mention that some of the folks will be coming up to Massachusetts. And I'm just wondering why we're not hearing about some of the other neighboring southern states taking on some more of these citizens. Because, I mean, as I said, I've been there before. My sister's lived there for a long time. She came recently in the winter, and it was very difficult for her, and she's not even a life, you know, long New Orleans resident.
Right, that's a big change of geography and climate. Prima Latisse, we've got that. Tony Oliver Smith, you've been patiently waiting. Let me put this to you. A number of things on the table here, but the stigma issue is kind of raised here again. I mean, people are going to be, and also the broken community issue, people far from their matrix of support of relatives and jobs and family, they will be by definition dependent on others for a while, and the jobs they had are not necessarily at all guaranteed where they land.
Yeah, that's going to be a major problem, in the sense that a lot of people define themselves, or at least a part of themselves, through what they do in the economy. And as a matter of fact, that's sort of a major issue in American culture. I think that one of the things that goes along with that sort of refugee identity is this whole stereotype that refugees are helpless, that they are without any kind of personal resources.
Mm.
And I think that tends to be very damaging. It's damaging to a person's self-respect and identity. And one of the, I think Rody mentioned it earlier, you move away from being an actor in your own life to being active, and then all of a sudden you're thrust into this passive kind of condition. And so I think one of the big challenges that goes along with the whole sort of refugee status and that stigmatization is moving back to being an actor in your own life, to taking some sort of charge of what's going on.
And what if your original home goes away, at least for a while, and maybe a long while in New Orleans? How do you reestablish that?
Yeah, that is the you know, represents the perhaps the largest part of the task is how do you reestablish yourself in those linkages, those human networks that sustain an individual.
Let me pick that up.
When you're basically a transplant and you have no connection to the local environment.
We've just got another minute here. Rody Chambliss, you called us last week on the air, and we were so struck with your passion and acuity about what you saw there. Where do you think this is going to go? We hear in the president of Tulane's voice, Scott Cowan, the determination to go back. We see it in your face and eyes. But you know there are no guarantees here. It's a bad situation. How is your family going to reestablish its own identity and community?
Well, community is already being established. People are finding each other where they land. Of the people that went to the shelter in Houston, they're finding neighbors or people they went to high school with. People are kind of reconnecting with the people that did survive.
Mm-hmm.
So people are trying. What needs to happen is that if the priority is set to rebuild the city, the people who love the city will go back and do their part. Allow them to participate in rebuilding. It's not going to be where the federal government is going to bring in, you know, other people, and then, you know, people who are displaced are going to wait, and then everything's going to be rebuilt, and then they'll go back. Involve them in the decision making process. Allow them to help to rebuild the city and help them to be active, you know, and not be just passive and waiting. And
make them players. They're ready. They're in your family, and you know it directly. Rody Chambliss, you're a terrific voice and representative of New Orleans, and we're grateful to you for being with us this hour. Thank you very much for coming in. And Tony Oliver Smith at the University of Florida. Professor Smith, thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.